Evening Public Ledger, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Thursday, May 20th, 1920. Bingles and Bungles. Naylor not only nailed the Tigers, but buried them. The A's now are three full box scores ahead of Detroit. Jimmy Dykes is taking healthy bets at the ball. He had 3 out of 4 yesterday. Naylor was the only member of the Max who did not hit safely, but he did enough. Indians here today. Trish Speaker will have something to say. Probably will be about pennant. Both Phils and A's are in 7th place. Getting to be like old times. The Phils have it on A's by 2 games. They've each lost 15 games. The Max have won 9 and the Cravathians 11. The Red Sox walloped Chakotay for 14 hits and just managed to nose out a 3-2 verdict. Stanley Kovalevsky blanked the Yanks with 6 hits. The A's will have to face the pole sometime during the present series. Doc Johnston is giving Joe Jackson a great battle in the batting race. Doc had 2 out of 4 yesterday. Ty Cobb improved his average considerably during his stay in our town. He had 7 hits out of 15 tries for a percentage of .446 against Mac Hurlers. The Cards have been blanked in 21 consecutive innings until they rallied yesterday against the Phils in the 5th inning. Davey Bancroft was more than half of the Phils' offense. David 3 out of 5 Cravath Bingles. The champion Reds haven't been able to swing into action for 2 days. It's wet in Cincy.
Hey, everybody. Podsman Josh here. I got my fellow Podsman Matthew on the line. How you doing, Matthew?
Doing well. How you doing, Josh? What's going on?
I'm, hanging in there. Another rainy day, you know, stuck inside. What are you going to do?
I feel like we record it. Every time we record, it's a rainy day, but the weather's been wonderful. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's a good rainy day activity. Sit inside and dig deep into the world of 1920s baseball.
It's one of our Bungles day. Yeah.
It's Bingles and Bungles. We're going to get
Bingles
into
Bingles and Bungles day. Yeah.
We're going to get into it. We're going to get into the Bingles and Bungles. I wanted to ask you if you saw one of our batsmen from 1920 was in the news in 2020 the other day. This past week, there was a story about a Shoeless Joe Jackson baseball card that turned up. Did you happen to see that?
Yeah, you shared that with me, and I couldn't believe it when you mentioned that to me.
So. It was so interesting because this guy found his dad's old cards, realized they were pretty valuable because cards from that era, we're talking, this card was from 1910, and cards from that era were pretty valuable, pretty rare tobacco cards. And then he was flipping through them and he was talking to his brother or somebody. And he was like, oh, because the card just says Jackson on the front. It doesn't say his first name. It says Jackson and it says he plays for the New Orleans Pelicans. And the brother says, oh, no, Joe Jackson would have been, Shoeless Joe would have been in the majors by then. And the Pelicans, that must have been a minor league team. That's probably nothing valuable. So the guy's looking through the other cards and eventually circles back and says, I wonder who this is then. And I'm like, well, who are the Pelicans? And he looks it up and Shoeless Joe did play on a minor league team called the New Orleans Pelicans in 1910. This was all news to me about Shoeless Joe because players typically stayed with one team their whole career. But Shoeless Joe came up in 1908, actually with the A's. He was in Philadelphia and he did not do well. And he did not like the city, the big city. He was not a city person. He did not do well. That must have been Connie Mack, right? The A's traded him to Cleveland at that point. He stayed in their minor leagues then for a little bit. So he was up in the majors 08, 09, 10 a little bit, then back down to the minors in 1910. That's like pretty unusual too, to have, it seems like, especially for like an all time great like that, to be like up and down in the majors and minors, especially at that time. So it was Shoeless Joe Jackson who was on the minor league New Orleans Pelicans in 1910, got that card made. And then soon after that, the Indians, of course, traded him to the White Sox. And that's when he went on to start him. So the discovery was that, oh, this is Shoeless Joe. And not only that, but the price tag on that card, $500,000.
Yeah, that's crazy. I saw the article, and I remember, like, some of the things that stood out to me is, like, they found, like, a huge pile of cards. I don't know where it was, but it was, like, inside, like, the container was, like, an old pot or something. Like
the lunch pail?
I can't even imagine. It's like some family pot or something that they found. Like, just, it wasn't just cards from like 1910. It was cards from like the 50s and 60s as well. I don't know if you caught that. I mean, I couldn't even believe finding, you know, stuff, cards from the 50s and 60s in a pot, let alone tobacco cards from the teens.
And then,
so, yeah, I was shocked at how much it went for as well. And yeah, it's not even that good of a grade, I think, right? It's like it was like a 3-something out of 10.
Yeah.
A low grade.
But it was, yeah, I mean, that's like the one card from that set. I guess that is the most valuable one. So that was quite a find. It was interesting to me to learn a little bit about Shoeless Joe. I didn't know that he had been in the minors. And down in his career, I didn't know he had traded twice before the White Sox. It's pretty unusual for that time. So I enjoyed that story. Yeah, I don't think I have any of those cards laying around. I don't think I have a lot from the 70s and 80s. I don't think I have any.
Yeah, all the stuff I have is the common stuff from the big bubble.
Yeah.
The late 80s, early 90s.
Still cool.
They mass produced them. Well, yeah, they're great. So, yeah, it just reminded me of, I think it was like an Antiques Roadshow episode I saw years ago. And they had like a Willie Mays uniform jersey from when he was in the minors. And it's, you know, it seems like the stuff from these Hall of Famers when they're in the minors, it's so rare and it's so fleeting. It's almost more desirable in some ways than the stuff when they're in the majors. So,
hey, I actually watched, I was watching some Antiques Roadshow the other day, and actually there was another 1920s name on there, but they had a Walter Johnson baseball on there, autographed ball.
That was, I mean, it was in the tens of thousands. It was really valuable, that guy found. So yeah.
Love it. Yeah.
Cool stuff. So yeah, we found this story then from the Philadelphia newspaper from May 20th, 1920. I have to look at some more to see if this was a series or a column or whatever you want to call it. Just doesn't have an author. But
I'm hoping it's a regular column because it's hilarious. The title of it is hilarious.
Yeah, so there's no author listed. There's no writer listed, but it's in the sports page, obviously, of the Evening Public Ledger in the Philly paper in 1920, and it's called Bingles and Bungles. Which neither of us can say without laughing.
No.
And neither of us is totally sure what it means.
Yeah, but we'll make a couple of guesses.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So bingles, I mean, it sounds like singles to me, obviously. And there's in the last little section, there's something about how the Cravathians had a few bingles, you know, the Phillies and the Cravathians. So yeah. I'm assuming that's it's like hits or singles or something, but I don't, you know, the bungles thing.
I guess he wanted something to contrast like hits and errors, but his own spin on is bingles and bungles. So
that's gotta be it.
Yeah. So it mentions Naylor. So this is Phillies centric or Philadelphia centric news, mostly Phillies and A's. That pitcher Naylor, we looked him up. He was Raleigh Naylor, who was a pitcher for the A's, who was extremely unlucky in terms of wins and losses. The A's were bad, but he's one of those pitchers with a really good ERA, but a really bad win-loss record. So there's a case he made that he's his Sabre bio says is Raleigh Naylor the unluckiest pitcher of all time. So he must have got the W against the Tigers. Although remember, of course, the Tigers were terrible at this time too. When it says that the A's are three full box scores ahead of Detroit, that just means what, three games in the standings, right?
I'm assuming, yeah.
Because remember, again, the Tigers really bad. So the A's being three games up on Detroit is not that impressive because they lost their first. Remember, Detroit lost their first like 15 or something games of the year. So
race for the cellar here in the American League.
Yeah, and I like this. I like how they're kind of zinging Tris Speaker. He's like, he must be have been kind of. They must be tired of hearing from Tris Speaker. Says Tris Speaker will have something to say. Probably will be about pennant. So obviously, Speaker was very confident coming into the year. The Indians were the favorites, but maybe Speaker was like maybe he was running his mouth a lot. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to find that out if Speaker was the kind of manager that, you know, that irked some of the sports sports writers.
Well, maybe that's why it's an unsigned article. So this guy could really let loose with the bungles. He could really just let him have it. I love that he calls the Phillies the Cravathians. Like, obviously, we've noted a few times that a lot of team names are named for their manager or nicknames. The Max for the A's, which kind of flows off the tongue. But Gavi Cravath is such a mouthful. But then they call him the Cravathians, which is fantastic.
It really is. It's like almost Greek in some sense. It's Greek mythology. Yeah. You know, like Jason and the Cravathians.
Yeah. And how funny is it that, like, it says Phils and A's are in seventh place, which is, you know, there's eight teams in the league. And then it says getting to be like old times. So, like, Phillies fans were already long suffering 100 years ago. Like,
yeah, they must have been like the Mets fans of Philadelphia back then. Like,
not only were they bad, but they were bad for so long that you can kind of hear him sighing in that, like old times. So.
Back to their old tricks.
Bingles and bungles. Yeah. Hopefully we got to find more of these. Let's set the stage a little bit. Let's do an overall standings recap of where the two circuits stand this week around May 20th. Today's the 22nd, 1920. Go ahead, Matthew. Give us the rundown of the standings.
All right. We'll start with the junior circuit here at American League. I think pretty consistently here, Cleveland has been separating themselves out. So they're at 21-8. They have a two-game lead over Boston.
Red Sox.
The Red Sox, yep. Who's at 18-9, two games behind. So they're doing really well after this Ruth trade. Again, I think we established it was very much like a value trade for them. They were able to get a lot of value out of that in terms of players and money.
Just money. Yeah. They didn't get any players.
I'm sorry. I guess, but they bought. Maybe managed to buy a few players and stuff with that money.
They just wanted cash, but they're still winning. So good for
them.
They're
doing well. Of course, the White Sox, the defending, American League champions. The White Sox, they're in third place, 16-11, four games out. Then you have the Yankees. They're starting to improve a little bit, but they're still right at 500, 14-14, 6.5. You have the Browns, another perennial basement dweller, over in St. Louis. Of course, for all of you who don't know, they moved to Baltimore. In the 1950s, and they're the Baltimore Orioles now, that franchise. They're seven out at 13-14. Then we have the Senators, 13-16, eight out. And then we have the Athletics and the Tigers, as we just mentioned. This is after today. So this is after the 22nd of May, 1920. The Athletics are 9-18, and the Detroit Tigers are 7-21. So they're in the cellar there. In the National League, we have a surprising team that I think we're going to talk about some more today, sitting in first place at 16-11. We have the Pirates, the Pittsburgh Pirates at 16-11. They're actually tied with the Reds, who we've also talked about a little bit about at 17-12. I think we did a little preview of them. So two surprising teams at the top, and then another surprising team, the Dodgers, just a half game back at 14-10. And then we have the Cubs, 16-15, two games out. The Boston Braves are below 500, 11-13, 3.5. So here the National League is a little bit more even so far compared to the American League. So we also have the Cardinals at 13-15. They're also 3.5 out. And then again, the Giants are not doing so well this year so far, but they're not too far out. They're at 11-15, 4.5 out, and then again the Phillies are in last at 11-18, six games out.
Those are your standings in this week in 1920s baseball.
So definitely some surprises there.
Yeah, and so I decided to dig into the Pirates a little bit. We did that game where we sort of did a reenactment of one of their games, so I've started to learn some of these names, but. Yeah, they're at the top of the standings. So I thought I'd just do a little team profile of our 1920 Pittsburgh Pirates. They are, to give you a little bit extra history, they're one of the oldest teams in baseball. The Pittsburgh club goes all the way back to 1881. They were called the Pittsburgh Allegheny at the time, which I think that's like a cool name. Name for the river, I guess. And they've been called the Buccaneers forever. That's like a super old nickname too. The Pirates and the Buccaneers were kind of like intertwined. I had assumed that was a modern thing, but that goes way, way back. They joined the National League in 1887, and they won the league a bunch of times. They played in the very first World Series, because if you remember those early days, there was the National League and the American League, and then finally there was you know, the two combined to make Major League Baseball and play for the series. And the Pirates were the NL rep in the 1903 series, but they lost. But they did win the series in 1909. In 1909, they were crazy good. They were 110-42. They beat the Tigers in the World Series that year. The Tigers' star was Ty Cobb. He was already up and crushing it that year. Do you know who the Pirates' star was in 1909?
I think Honus Wagner, right?
That's it. Honus Wagner, the believed by some to be the greatest shortstop of all times. He's from Pennsylvania. He's another one of those guys who grew up in the coal mines and was like, get me out of here. I am going to be a baseball player. And he was kind of unconventional in his build. They say he was very bow-legged and kind of like squat, but he was super strong and super fast.
Yeah, he
was
like a great huge hands, didn't he? Isn't that Honus Wagner? Like just monstrous hands?
I believe it. I didn't see it in my little thing I read about him, but I believe it.
I mean, his stats are insane. I think he's in the top three or four in hitting all time.
Yeah, some people definitely believe he's the greatest ever to play shortstop. His fielding was known for being tremendous also. And yeah, if you look at his hitting numbers, they're just phenomenal. So yeah, Honus Wagner was the star. He stuck around and played until 1917. I thought it was interesting at that point he didn't play short. They moved him over to first base, which is something like happens sometimes in modern game to a good hitter who doesn't have the legs to play in the field anymore. So I thought that was interesting. Well, of course, now too, he might be a DH, but it's interesting to me that as long ago as 1917, they were doing that move where they were sticking their old, now just in the lineup for his bat playing first. But they were terrible that year. In 1917, they were 51-103. So that's like, it's hard to get 100 losses in those days. You know, I mean, it's hard now, but there's more games played. So if you had 100 losses in a 50 versus 50 wins, you were pretty bad. So he retired. They were a little better in 18-19. And then they really started to get some good pitchers coming up. So here on this 1920 team, most of their really good players is their pitching staff. There's a guy named Wilbur Cooper, who was a 20-game winner many times. There was a guy named Babe Adams, who's considered one of the best control pitchers of all time. Where's the stat here? One walk per 14.6 innings. That's his in 1920. One walk per 14.6. So like point something walks per nine. His career average was 1.29 walks per nine, which is the second lowest of the 20th century. He also won.
Is he in the hall? I can't remember.
Babe Adams, I'm almost positive. It's interesting how many of these guys are in the hall and you don't, their names aren't known to even someone like us who like love this kind of stuff. There's a lot of dudes from that era in the hall who are kind of like forgotten names, but I did get a list of everybody who was active in 1920 who went on to make the hall. So I think that's going to be a whole episode. We'll run down all these guys.
That sounds great. Yeah, let's do that.
Some of them are forgotten about, like Babe Adams, who was a rookie in 1909 when they won the World Series. He won three of their games in the series. So imagine being a rookie in baseball bad 1909 and getting the call and the start. And if you got the start, you were in it. And then he got the win three of the four games in the series for the Pirates.
It was the series that Josh Beckett had, right?
He was
really young at that time, too, I think. I'm trying to think. Marlins series against the Yankees where he won a bunch. Yeah, just reminded me of that. Sorry for that aside.
The other guy they mentioned in the article I read about Adams was John Lackey, because that was the only time that the only other time a rookie started and won Game 7 in the World Series. So Lackey did it in 2002.
Oh, wow.
But, so the Pirates were in this, like, post-Honus phase. They would get good, really good, again in a couple years. They're sort of, like, not to, you know, give a spoiler for our standings here, but they're not going to be world beaters here in 1920. But they are coming out of their post-Honus doldrums. I believe that in a couple years, Rabbit Marinville joins the Pirates and so becomes their second great shortstop in a span of time. They also, if you look at the call-ups at the end of 1920, they have a guy with the excellent nickname of Pie, who's also in the Hall of Fame. That's Pie Trainer, who would go on to a huge career with the Pirates, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think, and I could be wrong, I think he was – at one point regarded as the greatest third baseman who ever lived. Now, of course, traditionally, I guess third base wasn't as, you know, as big of a hitting position as it is today. And, it, you know, kind of before the Bretts and the George Bretts and the Mike Schmidts of the world, you know, Pye was regarded as one of the all-time greats over at third. He was a great fielder, a great hitter. Didn't hit for a lot of power, but hit for a high average. I think he was the first third baseman elected in the Hall. So yeah, it looks like he didn't actually debut in 1920 until September.
Yeah, he came up right at the end of the year.
Yeah, had like a cup of coffee. Didn't play that well. Actually, came in as a shortstop.
Right.
And then he needed some more seasoning. He was kind of down in the back in the minors in 1922 for the most part, and really didn't start to develop and become a full-time player until 1923. I have a couple of notes here. It looks like he played tore up the Cape Cod League at Falmouth in 1919. So I guess he's one of the all-time at least in terms of history, because I guess the Cape Cod League is one of the most famous minor leagues in history. And so he's, you know, it was still going, it was going strong in 1919. So
yeah, that's cool. That's still around. You know, when I was up there not that long ago, I saw a bunch about the Cape Cod League. So I didn't get to see any games, but that's cool.
Of course, like the Cape Cod League is just, you know, it's just, it's like imprinted into my brain, that terrible movie with Freddie Prinze Jr. called Summer Catch.
I never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's like a summer romance.
Summer Catch. I get it.
from about, yeah, I don't know, 15 years ago. So Robert Maranville, as you just mentioned, sounds like he had a huge impact on when he came to the team on Pye, because he really struggled with his defense and probably kept him off the field for a while. Maranville really helped him with his fielding, and he moved over to third. And then it says actually that Rogers Hornsby helped him. He suggested him using a heavier bat. And after that, again, you know, this is all reports from the time, but apparently Hornsby helped him with his hitting. So, yeah, he was a player manager in the 30s. Lots of great stats. I think he hit about 320 or 330 all time. Again, he's in the Hall, first third baseman elected.
It's interesting.
It says here.
It's interesting that like third base was not, there aren't like so many like superstar third basemen from this era. Like there's superstar outfielders, superstar shortstops, but third base, yeah, seems to have been like not a spot where you put like your, well, sluggers didn't even really exist that much, but it's like, it seems like most of the really good hitting players were outfielders or shortstops or even the middle, like Hornsby, right? Like, who's the great third baseman of the early 20th century? Like, I can't think of anybody. Pye might have been the one.
It was Pye, yeah. I can't think of really anybody else either.
During the dead ball era, a home run Baker, I know. He was a good third baseman. But, yeah, that's interesting. The position definitely wasn't, like, what it is in the modern game. But, yeah, that's cool. So the Pirates were, like, you know, they were great, and then they were bad, and then they were mediocre, and then they are going to be really good again. They're on their way up to what the heck is his name? Kiki Kyler. That's a good name. Kiki is K-I-K-I. He becomes their star in a couple of years, joins Pye in that lineup, and they win it all again in 1925. So, again, you know, not to blow our timeline out of the water, but the Pirates, as of now, are in first place. So, you know, they don't have Pye yet, but they do have Babe Adams, and they do have some really good pitchers.
Yeah,
and they're off to
Possum. Possum Wooded. What a name!
Yeah, Possum. Yeah. They did have some really good names.
And of course, I think we were going to talk a little bit about their manager, George Gibson. It sounds like a soccer manager name, but George Gibson, of course, going back to your 1909 Pirates, was the starting catcher on that team. At this point, he's done playing. And we were just going to look at him real quick because he's actually got a pretty interesting career. So he's from like a small town in Ontario, Canada. He was just an abysmal hitter. But, you know, at the time, catchers were really predominantly responsible for just catching the game and keeping base stealers off the base paths. Of course, you know, as many of you know, the base stealing was a huge part of the game at the time, especially even more so, I think, when he was in his prime, which was in the aughts of 1900, I think his career like started around 1903 or 4. Anyway, so yeah, he's a light hitting catcher. He's an incredible fielder. He's known for his durability. I read an article where they called him like one of the last great dreadnought catchers. I'm not sure what that means other than, I guess, large and slow. And I think he had like 140 something game catching streak, which was the all time record till 1920. And he, you know, he was known for, you know, handling his pitching staff really well, which I think you can see here in 1920. And he's still got a great pitching staff, and for keeping runners on base. And they, I guess in 1909, of course, the like you said, the Pirates played the Tigers in the World Series, and you know, Ty Cobb was a notorious base thief, and apparently Gibson, I think, held him something to like one steal for the entire series. So yeah, so there's just a little bit of side there. Oh, and his small town, I apologize for not naming the town, I don't have it right here, but apparently they threw him a big parade when he came home in 1909 after the World Series. So yeah, just nice. Just a little player in American, and you know, in Major League history.
You know, the
impact there. So
yeah, the Pirates, I just, because of just the name, their backup catcher here in 1920 was Cliff Lee. So that's just the name that those of us who are modern fans recognize. You made a good point too, which is how important base stealing was to the game at the time. And that was part of this 1920 Pirates attack, was a lot of base stealers. They had this guy, Max Carey, who was considered one of the fastest guys in the game, and stole a ton of bases, led the league in steals in 1920, and then also in 22, 23, 24, 25. So Max Carey was part of the speedy Pittsburgh outfield. That's part of their attack. One other thing, just because it's interesting, you see their like uniform and their logo on these baseball reference pages. It's a navy blue. So I can't wrap my mind around Pirates not being black and gold, but they changed their color not until many years later, I think the 40s or 50s. So for a long time here, the Pirates were navy, and just doesn't seem right. I love the black and gold Pirates, the unis. Those are like one of my all-time favorites.
It's a classic uniform.
Yeah.
Sure.
So bringing up our next regular segment, I don't know if team profiles will be a regular segment. Probably will. It's fun to do, dive into. There's only 16 teams, so it's not like 1,000. But we also are bringing you the Sisler Watch.
Sisler Watch.
Yeah, there it is. George Sisler, in his quest to hit 400, is having some ups and downs. And where is he sitting this week in 1920s baseball? May 22nd, where's Sisler?
I mean, he's hitting pretty well. He peaked at 358 a couple of days prior. He's been really hot since May 4th. He raised his average about 60 points. He's hitting 349 after an 0-for-3 today, May 22nd. Yeah, he's still hitting pretty well here, 349. I think we'd take that any day of the week.
Yeah, so Sisler's at 349. So, I mean, yeah, obviously good numbers, but not near 400. So the Sisler Watch is going to take a little while to get up. He really gets hot, not really until the middle of June is when he goes on a crazy streak where he has a whole bunch of 3 and 4 hit games, and then the average gets way up. So, yeah. Nothing to sneeze at hitting 350, but for Sisler Watch, it's not close to the big four yet. And what else we got going on in this week in 1920? We found a couple articles that talked about some off-the-field stuff. The one was regarding the outlaw of the freak deliveries, all right, that we talked about. So there was, this was the first year where pitchers were not allowed to scuff up the ball. They did all sorts of crazy stuff to it, spit on it and put shoe polish on it and all that stuff. So, right, each team, if you remember, was allowed, what, 2 spitballers were grandfathered in?
Yeah, 2, what was the phrase they used? Freak deliveries?
Yeah,
so freak 2, deliveries. Yeah. So 2 from each team.
But then this week is when the umpires, or as they always called them, arbiters, the umpires were starting to crack down. So a guy from the Giants named Art Fletcher got, the headline says he was arrested, the first arrest under Baseball Prohibition Act. But what they mean was that the I don't know if he kicked him out of the game or if he made a point of cautioning him for doctoring the ball. So here's another just like funny little article. Quote, it says, Rube Benton, who's another pitcher, was cautioned several times early in the season about rubbing the ball in his shirt. And Bob Schocke of the Yanks, after being complained about in several games, narrowly missed the jug by rubbing the ball in the dirt. So I guess the jug means jail. Like they keep kind of joking that like these guys are getting arrested for messing the ball up. So
yeah, it seems like this is like the tipping point for their umps, because I think it mentions in the article that they were hesitant to enforce it. It had to really be a blatant before that they did it. So you can imagine the pitchers are kind of creeping right up to that line, crossing that line.
That's an interesting enforcement issue, right? Like how much is too much? And the pitchers are arguing, saying we need something to get a grip on the ball. They are arguing the ball was like too shiny and like you couldn't get a grip on it. It's so similar to what's happened in the past couple of years.
Yeah, there's a whole discussion about like what if the manufacturer could manufacture it in a way that it wouldn't be super shiny. Again, this is all going to lead up to our big discussion later this year.
Yes.
About the pitch.
The
pitch. Foreshadowing. Sizzler watch. I don't know. I mean, it's really interesting to me. Again, you found that great article by the umpire last episode, how these, because there's like not like a lot of precedent, I guess would be a good word for it. This is the first year that they've had to enforce this. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see if there's any more,
And the other big headline that happened to find from this week is players can keep baseball honest. Crooks will be driven out of the game. The full quote is, crooks will be driven out and game protected if gamblers are exposed. So we all know what happened in 1919 with the White Sox taking gamblers' money to throw the series, but it's not well known at this point in spring of 20. But this article clearly shows that, there were lots of whispers, maybe more than whispers. It wasn't totally known yet. But, it says if some of the honest players would agree to turn on the light, they'd be praised to the skies by fans all over the country who desire to have baseball played on the level. So it's like everyone knows that people were doing something dirty, but it's not quite out in the open yet.
Yeah, there was, I guess, the whole controversy. I totally forgot about that. The Hal Chase controversy where Christy Mathewson accused him of throwing games. He was acquitted, but he retired anyway. So there's like some undercurrents here that are happening. Something about the Cubs is mentioned.
It talks about a scandal in 1876. So going way back to.
Yeah, there's that scandal too, where there actually four players were permanently expelled.
Yeah.
Some 44 years prior.
So the writers and the fans and the general baseball public are starting to definitely perk their ears up and start to sniff out some of the wrongdoings that will come to light later this year about the just monumental scandal of 1919. So it's interesting to see it sort of unfold in real time, from the sort of, we think some to, first of all, it was just like, well, I guess the White Sox lost. And then it went to be like, oh, maybe that wasn't right. And then it was like, louder and louder drumbeats. And then, there's a formal investigation that comes later. And I'm not an expert on that yet, to be honest, but I thought it was interesting to see an article this early in the season where they flat out say like 99% of the players are honest, but there's 1% of them in there who are doing shady biz, and we gotta get them out of the game so we can keep it clean. So all in all, interesting stuff happening here in this week. A lot of different elements of the game come together, from the off field stuff to the.
Yeah, there's so much going on. I wonder if Ruth is behaving himself too in New York. We'll have to check in on him maybe next time.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of people say like, why hasn't there been a Last Dance, like that Michael Jordan documentary? Why hasn't there been something like that about baseball? And the answer is, like, you'd have to go back 100 years ago, because the last baseball player to achieve Michael Jordan level of dominance and also just personality is probably Babe Ruth. So he was it's funny though that the Yankees aren't like tearing it up. Like, it's not like he had this amazing year, but it's not like he came to the Yanks and immediately put them over the top in 1920. Took a little while until they assembled all the pieces. And maybe that's also part of it. Baseball is by its nature more of a team game. Like, you can't take over a game quite the way that
I watched this interesting by SB Nation, Dorktown, I guess is the people that made it, on YouTube recently about the history of the Seattle Mariners. And it was really interesting because it used like a lot of analytics and stats and graphs and stuff to kind of argue its points. But one of the key things is that at one point in the 90s, I think Seattle had they had four Hall of Famers. They had Ken Griffey Jr., they had Randy Johnson,
They had Alex Rodriguez and they had Edgar Martinez. Wow. And they still could not win a World. They didn't even get to the World Series. So, it really, I guess, just proves your point that, baseball really is truly a team game, and you can't even rely on four Hall of Famers. It's not like basketball, So, yeah. So the Yanks, even with Ruth, are still what? Well, they were 14-14, right, after today?
Yeah, they're a little bit mediocre. I think that about wraps it up for me. I am,
Well, you made that great generator. Let's talk about that.
Oh, all right. Yes. So this, talk about a ridiculous quarantine project. I spent some time. There's this site called Perchance. It's just like, it's really to help like learn programming. And there's a whole community around web HTML programming. And I used it a long, long time ago when I was learning some computer stuff. And it makes it really easy to do these things where you can program it to randomly generate things. So people use it for role-playing games or like character generation for like your D&D or whatever, just to like random number generators or to, and you can experiment as a programmer, like how to weight it to make certain things happen more often statistically and certain things be super rare. So anyway, what I did, because I'm obsessed with the nicknames of 1920s baseball, is I took like hundreds of baseball player names from that era, and I put there basically just three columns, first name, nickname, last name, and then I use the script to use the random generator. So the best way to find this is go to our Twitter page, 1920s Baseball, and you'll see the link for the old-timey baseball generator. And so what it does is it takes thousands of names of all real players, original first names, nicknames, last names, and it recombines them infinitely into new players. So you'll get all new old-timey players from all real parts. Do you have it up on your screen?
I do, because we got to read some of these. It's amazing.
These aren't all players from 1920. I went back a little further, and I was non-scientific in my approach. I just took any ones that I liked. So some of the first names that are hilarious, maybe they had a boring last name, so I just maybe took their first name. But these are all real names and all real nicknames. So go ahead and read this one.
Ed Foxy Paulette.
Ooh. Lloyd Hercules Brightstein.
A.G. Newt Parent.
Carson Cinders Glazier. Cinders. Like, that's a... What did you do to get the nickname Cinders?
Herman Roxy Styles.
Nice. Oh, Carson Howdy Martin. Some of them I recognize. Like, Howdy, I recognize. Howdy Catan, right? The shortstop for the Pirates.
How about Jeremiah Peach Pie Crabtree?
Oh, man, that is really good. Jeremiah Peach Pie Crabtree. Pie Trainer's nickname also apparently originally was Pie Face, by the way. And he got that as a little kid just because he ate a lot of pie. It's just like you do one thing and it's like that's your name for the rest of your life.
Yeah, apparently like a baker or something like down the street from where he lived where he used to just always go in, started calling him Pie Face.
Hey, Pie Face. Pie.
Yeah, so yeah, it's amazing.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think your 1920s nickname would be?
Oh, man, that's tough. Well,
why do you think about that? I'll say also that one thing we found while looking up these old-timey names was a player who shared your surname. We found a ball player from the early 20th century, the last name of Rothfuss, which is not the most common last name in the world, and got us me wondering if that's a relation of yours.
For those of you out there, please, yeah. Let us know. No, we'll definitely we'll maybe talk about him a little bit more. Jack Rothfuss.
I feel like my nickname would probably be Specs. Any guy who wore glasses was Specs. I feel like I would just be Specs. Or also one of the nicknames I found was Bucketfoot, which is like when you're afraid of the pitch and you step in the bucket, that's like somebody's derisive nickname was Bucketfoot. So I feel like those are the hallmarks of my playing career, having poor eyesight and being afraid of the ball. I'm either going to be Specs or Bucketfoot.
I can tell you a nickname that I don't think I would be, but I would love to be, is Haas, because I think it's hilarious.
Yeah, I can see you as a Haas.
Like, what a Haas.
I can see you being
like, Get on your Haas. Yeah. Get on your Haas, Rothfuss.
The other thing we noticed was that, like, some places are cool nicknames and some places aren't. Like, Tennessee is a cool nickname. Tex, obviously, is a cool nickname. Carolina. There's a guy named the Mississippi Mudcat. That's pretty awesome.
Indiana works.
Montana. But like Pennsylvania, that's not a name. Or like any of the new state. You can't be like New York. Like that's don't know.
Nah, but you could do like, you could take off the new and you could do like, you know, Jersey Mike.
Yeah, Jersey Mike is a highlight. It seems like the New England, like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Vermont, like nobody's nickname is just Vermont.
Too much of a mouthful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of guys were obviously named for where they were from. Here's one that I didn't name generator. Al Sweetbread Weckbecker. And we know Sweetbread. Martin Sweetbread was definitely a pitcher on the Cubs. I know that.
It's just so good.
I like when the nickname is like a name that does not match with their first name. That's funny. Charlie Bonehead Witz. Bonehead. Oh, Old Tomato Face was definitely a real nickname. Noodles.
Ham Kamnitz.
Fred T. Spinach Haynes. That's every once in a while I included middle initials just to mix it up. Wally Peekaboo Ward. We could probably do this for a super long time.
And yeah,
We will refer you, the listener, to the 1920s baseball Twitter feed, and you can generate as many weird nicknames as you want. Send us your favorites. And
can we put that up on the website too? Is that possible?
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll have Twitter. Yeah.
We'll link that up a couple different places.
Perfect.
So enjoy yourselves. This is Josh Bucketfoot Burke, Matthew Haas Brothfuss. I like it. It's got a ring. I also might have a beard-related nickname at this point because I haven't shaved since March 13th. So, but that's a. I'm gonna go with Bucketfoot. That's got a ring to it.
I love it.
All right, Haas.
All right, Bucketfoot. Until next time.
Take it easy. Sign it out. All right.
Later.
Bye bye.